Have a seat. We're going to get started. We don't want to feel rushed, and we do want to eat on time. Have time for the table setters to set the tables. If I preach loud enough, then maybe I'll knock the tower over. Oh, it's hard to walk around it. Dan, if I say any heresy, just knock it over. It's good to be with you all. It really is. Let me pray. God, as we open up the book of Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews, we ask that you would open our eyes to be able to see. Help us to focus our eyes on the thing that we need to focus on. Help us, by your Spirit, to understand how these words can be applied to our lives. Help me to speak with wisdom, with grace, with truth, and with love, and help us all to understand what you would speak to us. We thank you that you do speak. Amen. This morning, because I'm assuming that you haven't yet read all of Hebrews in preparation for this, which you still have a chance to, I've tried to make it easy for you by, I preached Hebrews and just recorded it on my phone. It's not amazing recording quality, but we won't have time to read through all of Hebrews right now during the lecture series. We did that with Philippians, if you remember, but it would take about 40 to 50 minutes to do that. So I recorded that and I uploaded it on students.bodenshof.de. You can listen to it if you want. If you go on a walk today, you can just listen to me preaching Hebrews as though it's a sermon, which, hint, hint, it is a sermon. It's actually a sermon. It's more of a sermon than a letter, unlike some of the letters of Paul, for instance. And we're just going to look this morning at the first three verses. We're going to go through a bit of background so that we can understand Hebrews in its context, and then we will look at the first three verses. So I will preach or teach this week as though you haven't read Hebrews so that you won't be completely lost, but it would probably enrich your time to go ahead and do that. So we're just going to look at the first three verses, and I've titled this lecture, The Radiant Sun. It's a pun. What do you know about Hebrews already? Just go ahead and call it out. I'll repeat it into the mic for the sake of recording, but let's just, whether you've read it or not, just heard about it, what's a couple things you know about it? Yeah. Okay, ties in Jesus with the Old Testament quite a bit. Good, thanks. The author is unknown. All right, yeah, we'll talk about that this morning. Jesus is the high priest, presented as the high priest in Hebrews, yeah. That was what he was going to say. Very good, yeah. Written to the Hebrews, yeah. Hebrew, Jewish audience, very good. Not like some of the other letters where we know what city it was written to. It was written to just in general Hebrews. We'll talk a little bit. We kind of have some good guesses of who was the first audience based on the content of the letter. Let me introduce the book of Hebrews in a way that you probably haven't had it introduced before. Hebrews is like a roller coaster. You start ticking up very slowly. There's actually kind of an intentional, slow, methodical start to the book of Hebrews. And as you're going up, there's a little bit of fear, a healthy fear. If you were at a height like this, a healthy fear that starts ticking up, you kind of look over to the side and you see how exciting life is, and you see how dangerous falling would be, and you tick, 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 go higher. You look around, you're freaking out, and it helps you get through emotionally. If you have a friend right next to you, hold their hand, right? If you've ever been on a roller coaster, maybe you have somebody there next to you to comfort you and counsel you. And meanwhile, you're going higher and higher, and then you level off, and you wonder why you got yourself into this. But you remember the smiling faces of all the people who've gone on the ride before you while you were waiting in line. And they look like they were happy, satisfied, if not a little windswept. And now you're at the top and you see how threatening life is. And the ride is causing you to think, okay, I have to trust the designer. I have to trust the architect of the roller coaster. I have to trust the engineers who tested it. I hope this works. And then you go! And you go down the first little loop and you're feeling the G-force of your body as you're flipping upside down. And you're realizing that the seatbelt is nothing compared to the G-force in your body as you're inverted into oblivion. No, that little thread of string is woefully insufficient to bring you back to safety. You look down at your safety belt, the thing everybody clicked in at the beginning of the ride, the thing the attendant waltzed by and haphazardly checked to see if everyone's clicked in, but didn't check how tight it was or how loose it was or anything. When you look down at the safety belt, you realize somehow you unclicked it. The little metal flappy thing got stuck on your clothing and it came undone. Oh no, what will you do without your seatbelt? Let's admit it, you knew the seatbelt did nothing. It was just meant to give you something to do, maybe to comfort you a little bit, maybe just to serve as a warning to take yourself, to take this seriously, but ultimately it did nothing. The only great comfort that you have was this bar that came down, this solid steel bar that came click, click, clicking before any of the tick, tick, ticking of the ride. This solid steel bar that came down and locked you in with inevitability. You clicked the seatbelt, but you had no power over the safety bar. The safety bar was going to come down whether you did anything or not. That thing came by its own power. It slammed you into place. That solid steel bar is not going anywhere. It is an anchor that you can press your body against that's not going anywhere. So you cling, you hold. That's all you can do. No matter how much fear you have, you dig your fingernails into it. You get to that point where your fingers are like, it's like they're stuck when you finally get off the ride and you have to pry your fingers off of the bar. You bite down, you press the side of your face against the safety bar. And you don't really have to actually do any of those things. If you passed out and you went limp, the safety bar would hold you in place. The safety bar would hang your ragdoll body in place. But you do. You wrap your fingers around it through every twist and turn so that you hold so tight so that when the ride is over, you have to be pried off of it. And it was worth every second of waiting. It was worth overcoming your fear. And your appreciation for solid ground and home is so much sweeter. That's like the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews is a roller coaster ride. Now, clearly that's an analogy, but what is it analogizing? Who is Jesus in the analogy? He's not the safety belt. He's the safety bar, right? The safety belt was just this insufficient comfort, this signpost, this reminder, this pointer to the fact that life is dangerous and you do need help. But ultimately, the safety belt wasn't doing anything. It was the bar. Going through the roller coaster with only a seatbelt is tenuous at best, and it's dependent on your own competence. The seatbelt is the old covenant. It's the law of Moses. Is Jesus the architect of the roller coaster? Is he the engineer? Is he the mechanic? Is he the safety inspector? Is he the tracks? Is he the operator? Is he the person sitting next to you, comforting you? Is he the person who went before you so that you saw that it was safe? And the answer, according to the author of Hebrews, is yes. He's all of those things. Jesus is all of it. He's just all of it. Jesus is everything you need. That's what the author of Hebrews says. Jesus is everything you need. Jesus is the Son of God. He's the firstborn. He's the first fruits of a resurrection to come. He's the Son of Man. He's the perfect human, the better Adam, the better high priest who leads us into right relationship with God. He is the tabernacle and the temple. He's the veil, the entrance through which we access God. He's the Christ, the Messiah, the Lord, the name above all names, the best Jewish guy, the true Israelite. He's the author, the finisher of our faith. He's the Alpha, the Omega. He's the perfecter, the pioneer, the champion, the apostle, the brother sent on our behalf. He's the mediator between us and God and us. He's the king. He's the very representation of God. He's the ransom for sins. He's the redemption price that sets us free, and he's the great shepherd of the lost sheep. All of that just in Hebrews. All of those are literally word for word ways that the author of Hebrews presents Jesus. This is the book of Hebrews. Life is a journey. Life is a journey from being broken and tired and weary into rest. Life is a journey from being a foreigner, being a stranger, being alienated away from the presence of God into the presence of God. Life is a journey from being orphaned to being adopted into the family. And the only way you're going to get through that journey, it's a long journey. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. There's ups and downs in this journey. And the only way you're going to get through the journey is by fixing your eyes on Jesus. That's how you get home. That's how you get home. This week, I want to dance with you. I want to dance with you, meaning I want to have a little bit of interaction. So don't make me dance by myself. It's Napoleon Dynamite levels of awkwardness, okay? We got to dance. So you got to think and you got to interact with me a little bit. So we're going to do this. Let's just share with a partner right now. Life is a journey where you're asking this question, how do I get home? Here's the question for you to answer right now. When was the last time you felt home? Share that with a partner or a group of three if you're at a table of five. You have 60 seconds now. All right, let's come back together. I'd be so curious and wish we could take the time to just hear from every single person what that was. I'm glad that you could share that with each other a little bit. It's a huge privilege to me that some of you maybe were even thinking, yesterday when you came back from travel weekend, that was a time of homecoming. That's a beautiful thing to me. You're off in the Morocco sands or whatever. You're clearly not home there. But when you come back to a community like this, that feels like home. I know, sadly, for some of you, you felt like you haven't been home in a long time. I kind of feel that sometimes. I'm a foreigner in a foreign land, in a strange land, right? I'm an immigrant. Today, I have to go to the immigration office. I have to apply and do all this paperwork. And it's just so clear to me in moments like that I'm not home, right? My citizenship is somewhere else. But when I go back to the U.S., I also don't feel home. That's one of the tricks of having lived a while in a foreign country. I also don't feel home. Where should I go home to? I have no family and friends in Colorado, where I've spent most of my life. I have no family in Oregon. My wife's family is in Oregon. There's a bit of a home feeling for her, but I have no family there. My mom lives in Kentucky. My brother and sister live in Houston. I've never lived there. Where should I go home to? When people ask me, when are you going back home? I just have to think and smile to myself, I don't know what that means. 5 o'clock, I'll go home. See my kids. Psychologist Kurt Thompson said, we're all born into this world. Think about a newborn baby. We're all born into this world looking for someone, looking for us. That's home. You're born into this world looking for someone, looking for you. A community, a fireplace that you can sit around and eat and smile and laugh and drink together. That's home. That's home. Being welcomed, being embraced, being able to rest. That's home. Some people run away from their home looking for home. Some people run to Bodensehof looking for home. Some people run from Bodensehof for an afternoon or for a free Saturday looking for home in all the wrong places. The answer to the author, for the author of Hebrews, is the only way to get home, the only way to walk this long up and down journey with lots of twists and turns, is to fix your eyes on Jesus and to find out that he is everything you need. To hold hands with brothers and sisters and to unlock this secret power of being able to actually love other people and embrace other people the way that we wish we could be embraced. To look for other people, to look at other people the way that we wish we could be looked for and looked at. Our strength is renewed when we fix our eyes on Jesus, when we accept his love every single day, to be able to stretch ourselves out in love for others, even when it doesn't love us back. We fix our eyes on Jesus. We see that he understands our pain and he cheers us on. When I was preparing this lecture series, it took me a while to prepare. It took me years of thinking about it, reading, and frankly, having fear to even do it, to risk it. And yet, I was always looking for some new angle, some fresh take, some amazing bomb drop moment and all I could come up with was, it's just Jesus. It's just Jesus, 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 and more Jesus. There's not that much profound or new stuff that I'm going to share this week. But what I'm going to do is what the author of Hebrews does, which is just show you Jesus again and again and again, and how good Jesus is again. And if we fix our eyes on Jesus, maybe it gives us the courage to get through the journey. Hebrews has taught me that I don't have to be clever or perfectly organized. I just have to cling to Jesus. Just press my face against him, hold on to him, grip him, and know it's all going to be okay. Jesus Christ is going to hold on to me. If you all give me a bad teacher evaluation, Jesus Christ is going to hold on to me. Hebrews has helped me not to care so much what other people think, not to compare myself to other teachers, other people, other staff, but just to have compassion, just to say one thing that could be an encouragement to one person. It's helped me become more stable in a fragile time. I'm steady when I'm looking at Jesus. I'm steady when I'm looking at Jesus. The wonder of reading Hebrews is lost on modern audiences. It's lost on us because actually we're so saturated in what Hebrews taught the church that it's not new anymore. But if we didn't have Hebrews, then we would have lost a lot, because Hebrews does give us the key to reading the Old Testament. It reads the Old Testament in a fascinating, Jesus-centered, Trinitarian even way. It affects our whole interpretation of how we understand Jesus. It changes so much about what theology is, which is hard to see now because it's not new to us, but it's so, so vital, so, so important, and somehow we sometimes forget it. And so we're going to just jump in again to Hebrews and let it teach us, let it soften our hearts to Jesus again. Who's the author of Hebrews? We don't know, ultimately. Hebrews actually, you know, you just have to trust me on this, and I just have to trust the people who know Greek really well, because I don't know Greek that well. All Greek seems clunky to me. But the people who know Greek really well say that the best Greek in the whole New Testament is Hebrews. It's just amazing rhetoric, right? Rhetoric just means like skill in communication. It's amazing skill in communication. It's got all these unique and very fancy words. The person who wrote Hebrews must have been well educated, must have had a considerable vocabulary. and a huge knowledge of the Old Testament. The author of Hebrews is constantly quoting the Old Testament, referring to the Old Testament, and so this is why we say that he must be speaking to a Jewish audience. So there's some options out there. There's some options on who could be the author of Hebrews. Some people do say it's Paul, and Paul is just writing in a different way because most of the other letters of Paul are written to a Greek audience, so maybe he's speaking to a Jewish audience. Some people think it's Priscilla, could be a she who wrote it, and maybe that's why Priscilla doesn't write her name. Priscilla is always named Priscilla and Aquila. They're the power couple of the New Testament church. And Priscilla is always mentioned first, which is very, very noteworthy in the ancient world. You almost would never refer to the wife's name before the husband's name, and because whatever you say first is the most important in the Greek world when it comes to sentence structure. So maybe it was Priscilla. Maybe it's Titus, could be. It seems like somebody who's kind of familiar with the world of Paul, because a lot of the ideas, although the language is different than Paul, a lot of the ideas are similar to Paul. And so it could be someone like Titus or Luke. One time I was reading through Acts, and I came upon this sentence, and I thought, Cameron Tate, you amazing, clever genius slash detective, you have found the author of Hebrews, because I read this in Acts 18. Meanwhile, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue when Priscilla and Aquila, power couple, heard him. They invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more adequately. When Apollos went to go to Achaia, the brothers and sisters encouraged him and wrote to the disciples there to welcome him. When he arrived, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed. Verse 28, for he vigorously refuted Jewish opponents in public debate, proving from the scriptures. Wouldn't you like a soundbite of whatever he said to prove from the scriptures? That Jesus was the Messiah. So I was reading Acts 18, and I go, I figured it out! Apollos is the author of Hebrews. I'm the first person in the world to ever think of that. And then I realized that actually most of the commentators say, Apollos is a really good candidate for having written Hebrews. Okay, so Cameron wasn't the first person ever in church history to think that Apollos was it, but I'm going to go with Apollos, right? Some follow Paul, others follow Peter, I follow Apollos. when it comes to this, right? Maybe it was Melchizedek, though, who wrote it. Who knows? Where did that guy come from, and where is he going? I go with Apollos, but ultimately, it actually doesn't matter. The author of Hebrews is Jesus. That's kind of the point. The author, maybe that's actually why the author didn't include his or her own name, because they just wanted to start out with a bit. You know, usually you would go like, hey, Paul, this is me and Timothy. We say, what's up, right? That's how you start most letters. This one just starts with a bang. It just starts with Jesus, right? Well, it starts with God spoke, and then who did he speak by? Jesus. So, could be that. When was this written? We don't know, but almost certainly it was written before AD 70. Now, why would we say that? What happened in AD 70? Common Era 70. The temple was destroyed, right? There was some Jewish people in Jerusalem that had a little rebellion against Rome. Didn't go that well. Jerusalem was attacked. The temple was destroyed. Now, if I was writing the book of Hebrews, this is going to become apparent later on, and I was talking about the insufficiency of the Old Covenant and the temple sacrificial system, you know what would have been really great proof for that? To go, guess what? The temple was destroyed. Remember how the temple was destroyed? And I would just write my whole letter or sermon about how the temple was destroyed, so clearly it can't be used anymore. Well, the author of Hebrews doesn't do that, so it's probably before AD 70. It's certainly after some events where Jewish Christians were being persecuted. Because ultimately, this is a letter of encouragement, which leads us to who's the audience. The audience seems to be people who are very familiar with Jesus, right? Christians. People who are very familiar with the Old Testament, so let's go with Jewish Christians, and people who are having a hard time. People who are wondering, if all of these promises of following Jesus are true, then why am I having such a hard time? That's got to be a question on the minds of the original audience. In Hebrews 10, 32 through 34, it says that the audience was resilient in sufferings. They had experienced some amount of suffering already, and they were publicly exposed to trouble. So it has to be at least a couple decades going on into the life of the church. So probably after the 50s, 60s, but before 70. So we've got a pretty narrow window, actually, of when this hit. Here's what a lot of people might think, a lot of scholars. It's written to Jewish Christians in Rome, who after Pentecost, right, Jewish Christians started following Jesus. And then in Rome specifically, there was a lot of fighting between Jews who didn't follow Jesus and Jews who did follow Jesus, right? So there was a lot of fighting in the synagogues and whatever. And there was actually so much fighting that Emperor Claudius, the emperor at the time, he kicked all of the Jews out of Rome, out of the city of Rome. Not the empire, but the city. That was in AD 49. And it didn't matter if you're a Christian or if you're a non-Christian, he just kicked all the Jews out. And all of those people were shamed and imprisoned and they were stolen from at that time. I think this is what Hebrews 10 is referring to. Hey, you guys got through that wave of persecution really well. You bore the shame. You followed Jesus' example. You considered it even a privilege to be persecuted in that way. But then what we know is that 5 years later, Emperor Claudius died, and a guy named Nero became emperor. Nero allowed all of the Jews back in. Whether they were Christian or non-Christian, he allowed all of the Jews back in. But then, 10 years into his reign, so AD 64, there was this big fire that broke out in Rome. It was a big event in Roman history. A big fire broke out in Rome, and everybody kind of started blaming Nero. And Nero shifted the blame away from him onto this minority little group, minority religion called Christianity. Nero started persecuting Christians. And so here's the situation you can imagine. You went through a wave of persecution because you were Jewish. You're a Jewish Christian. Now you're going through and you couldn't do anything about that. You're Jewish no matter what, right? Now you're going through a wave of persecution because you're Christian a few years later. How tempting would it be to then deny Jesus, say, I'm not Christian anymore, I'm just Jewish, because Jews were not persecuted under Nero. They actually had a religious exemption. How tempting might it be to say, oh, I'm not really Christian, I'm just Jewish. And how easy would it be to justify that by going, well, certainly God has been faithful to his people all along. Are the Jews not still the people of God? I can have a relationship with God. I can have a vibrant relationship with God just by being Jewish. Yes, Jesus was this like side benefit of having ability to be close to God, but he's not really needed. I'm still a part of the people of God just by being Jewish. Can you imagine that? That's the situation that the author of Hebrews is addressing. He's saying, don't give up on Jesus. Yes, in the past, God did reveal himself. God did show himself. God did relate to people in various ways, at various times, through the prophets, through the temple system, through the high priest. There was a way of being connected to God, but now we've got Jesus. And when you have Jesus, you cannot go back to anything else. Jesus is the way, way better way of relating to God, and he's actually the only way. Everything else was pointing to him. If you reject Jesus, you've actually rejected the whole thing. That's one of the main points. And actually, the way that the author does this, it's quite clever. he gives a eulogy for Jesus. A eulogy is what you say at a funeral. The most close fit of what the letter of Hebrews is, you could say it's a sermon, but ultimately it's a speech that's commending a dead person. That's what a eulogy is called. Except this is a really exciting eulogy because it's like you're speaking about how great this guy was, and then he pops out of the grave, and then he flies into the heavens. That's an exciting eulogy. I hope that's what my eulogy looks like. But that's the form or the style. It's like a sermon. It's like a speech saying, look at all of the great things that this guy Jesus Christ did. And then there's sort of a surprise twist ending to the eulogy where it's like, and he's still living, and he's still doing great things, and he will do great things forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Amen. So why was this book written? What's the purpose of this book? We kind of see the purpose of it through the lens of the original audience. There's no major issue that he's addressing, that the author is addressing. There's no major heresy, right? It's not like 1 Corinthians where Paul just comes out swinging and he's just like, okay, here's this massive problem that's happening in the church. No, he's actually just writing a letter to encourage, to commend, to prop up Jesus, and to warn that if you abandon Jesus, you're going to lose everything. The author's not trying to prove a thesis, but trying to praise Jesus. Praise, lift up Jesus. Christ and faith in Jesus, these are the things that are the most valuable, most worthwhile things. So there's lots of things at play. There's like, it's in the context of an honor and shame culture, trying to honor Jesus and actually show that Jesus' shame was his honor, which is unlike anything that the ancient Roman world would have really understood or accepted. But he's making Jesus and true faith so attractive that it would be shameful to turn back, turn your face away from Jesus, or to carry on with the old beliefs and behaviors that were okay to embrace in Old Testament times. Some people look at the book of Hebrews and they just see it's like the highest Christology in the Bible. There's such a high position for Jesus. Jesus is, this is also true in elsewhere in the New Testament, but you see extremely clearly in the book of Hebrews, Jesus is God. You just see it again and again. The way that the author of Hebrews quotes the Old Testament is by saying sometimes the Holy Spirit says, sometimes God says, and sometimes Jesus said or spoke, right, in the old times. So you see the Trinity and this high view of Christology all being commended. Why? Because, again, life is a journey. The only way you can get home, the only way you can arrive at the final destination safely is, Hebrews 12:2, to fix your eyes on Jesus. 13 chapters long, one main point. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Lots of ways of saying that, lots of ways of presenting Jesus, lots of ways of bringing that truth home. But one major point, fix your eyes, fix your eyes, fix your eyes on Jesus. Let's read those first few verses together. Hebrews 1, 1 through 3. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. What we see here is the point we're going to see again and again. The author of Hebrews shows that there is continuity and fulfillment and escalation from how God spoke in the Old Testament to how he speaks in the New Testament. This is not a rejection of the Old Testament. In the past, God did speak through the prophets. God did speak through Moses. God did speak through Elijah. Now he's speaking still, continuity, escalation, and fulfillment through Jesus. There's a better lens through which we can understand Jesus. This is not an attack against Judaism, but it's a completion argument. Judaism finds its perfect complement, completion, in Jesus. It's clear to the Jewish Christians, you can't be Jewish without ending in Jesus. That is the only proper end to all reading the Old Testament, all understanding of the ancient Hebrew way of life. The first few verses are representing that Jesus, this is casting a vision of Jesus as the radiance of the sun, which cannot be separated from the sun itself. When you look at the sun, everybody go out today, it's going to be sunny, stare at the sun for 1 hour. Okay, Cameron's official recommendation, this is the will of God for your lives, stare at the sun for 1 hour today. Just kidding, don't do it. It's a bad idea. You'll burn your eyes out. If you stare at the sun, can you separate the sun on a sunny day? Can you separate the sun from its radiance? No. To look at the sun is to look at the radiance. To look at the radiance is to look at the sun. To look at God, the Father, is to look at the sun. Other sun, spelling. To look at the sun is to look at God. The word that's used in 1:3, the exact representation, it's the word karakter. He is the exact character. He is the exact imprint. It's actually like the word that you would use for a stamp, right? When you stamp wax, you get the exact mirror image imprint of what you stamped. It's the exact same thing. Jesus is the exact same thing as God the Father. We know what God looks like by looking at Jesus. The abstract becomes personal. I could read you off a list of facts and accomplishments and a biography of Catherine. That's my wife for the Taste and See guest. Welcome, Taste and See guest. I could read a list of all of the places she's been and all of the accomplishments and things that she does for hobbies, but you only know Catherine when you've been with Catherine, when you've met Catherine face to face, when you've shook her hand, when you've given her a hug, when you get to know how lovely she is, that's when you know Catherine. You don't know Catherine by reading a list of her accomplishments. You don't know God by reading a list of his accomplishments. You know God when you know Jesus. You know God when you know Jesus. Every time that you forget what God is like, every time you have a little bit of a shadow of a doubt, is God really like this? He seems pretty mean. You get to know Jesus. How? Read the Gospels. Ask people about their experience of Jesus. When you start to have doubts about God and if he's good, read a gospel again and get to know Jesus. Maybe read Hebrews. Get to know Jesus. Ask other people about their experience of Jesus. If you have a misunderstanding of God, it can be most helpfully corrected by focusing on Jesus, fixing your eyes on Jesus. Oh, reminding yourself that the Holy Spirit is with you as you fix your eyes on Jesus. And the next point, I don't really need to make because you had a crossing about it. He sat down. When do you sit down? You sit down when your work is done. Jesus' work is done. That is his purification of sins. His saving work is done. The book of Hebrews is ultimately, can be broken up like this. This is at least how I would break it up. What has Jesus done? What is Jesus doing? What will Jesus do? These are the three fundamental driving questions for us as we look at Hebrews this week. What has Jesus done? what is Jesus doing? The author of Hebrews doesn't just talk about this stuff that Jesus has already done. He sat down because there's no more purification of sins needed. But Jesus is still doing something. I don't think Thomas talked about that part of the book of Hebrews. And Jesus will still do something. And these questions are not abstract questions. These questions are also for you to answer. What has Jesus done for you? What is Jesus doing for you now? I think we've often missed what Jesus is still doing. We talk a lot about what Jesus has done, and that's great. We can also talk about what Jesus is doing for you right now, and we will also talk about what Jesus will do in the future. At the very least, we know from these first three verses, what has Jesus done? He has radiated and revealed who God is. Jesus reveals more clearly than anything else who God is. He's sustaining all things, and he has sustained slash created all things, and he's purified sins. He's done with that work. There's no more purification of sins left. That's going to be a much more important point later in the week. His work of purification, his work of atonement of sin, it is finished. He's still doing work. But the work that he's doing now is not sacrificing himself again and again and again and again. The work that he's doing now is not dealing with your sin anymore. That's done. That's done. And he will come again, but he's not going to come again to forgive sins, because that's already done. And you'll have to wait to find out more about that. For now, I want to leave every lecture open for some interaction, for some questions, and or some, sometimes discussion, sometimes openness to share in this group. Here's a non-rhetorical question. You know what a rhetorical question is? It's a question that you don't really answer. This is a non-rhetorical question. So what does that mean? I want you to actually answer this, if anybody's brave enough. What are you in danger of shrinking back into when you get home? So I'm going to assume that nobody here is in danger of shrinking back into Judaism. Raise your hand if you are in danger of shrinking back into Judaism. We actually did have someone last year, and she had a very, very unique upbringing and family story that rose her hand and was serious about that. But for most of us, especially if you're not Jewish or don't think you are, then you're not in danger. But maybe for an evangelical, maybe for a Western Christian, what are you in danger of shrinking back into? Is anyone bold enough to share when you get home? Yeah, Josh.
Focusing more on the mundane life rather than my relationship with Jesus.
Thank you.
Prayer becoming a chore instead of a joy.
Thank you, yeah.
An avoidance of those I have a hard time loving.
Shrinking back into avoiding people that it's hard to love. Yeah.
Being heavily influenced by my secular friends.
Being influenced by secular friends or the world, yeah.
Getting back on the TikTok and Reels grind.
Oh, danger of shrinking back into social media.
The aesthetic of Christianity.
Okay, the aesthetic of Christianity. I want to know more, but we don't have time.
Letting fear be my final authority rather than God.
Okay, yeah, fear rather than God being your authority. Thank you all for that. I think it would be very helpful for everybody to have either written down or very clearly thought through what is something that you're in danger of shrinking back into. Because the rest of this lecture series is trying to do what the author of Hebrews is doing, which is encourage you to fix your eyes on Jesus in order to not fall into that, to give you courage, power, the presence of God to be able to keep you going along the journey to get home. Let's pray. God, we need you. We thank you for what you have done. Even though we don't know all the things that you're up to or that you will get up to, we thank you for those in advance. God, we want to have clear eyes, clear vision to be able to fix our eyes on you. So help us to really think about those things that we are coming out of, still coming out of, or need to come out of in order to be able to take one step forward. Help us along this journey. Be our safety bar. Be our friend who sits next to us. Be the example who's gone before us. Be the thing that keeps us safe. Be our hope. In your name I pray. Amen.